The headlines: Iran's President Hassan Rouhani rules out any changes or addition of new members to the 2015 nuclear deal. Myanmar's police filed charges against ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi for breaching an import-export law seeking her detention until February the 15th. And World Health Organization experts visit a laboratory in the Chinese city of Wuhan as part of their hunt for the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's president says the United States should comply with the UN Security Council resolution that endorsed the 2015 nuclear deal.
The Americans should know that they have so far violated UN Security Council Resolution 2231. It's not a matter of Iran and its nuclear deal. I'm telling the Americans that it is Resolution 2231 that is the issue. It is a resolution unanimously approved by the UN Security Council.
President Rouhani reiterated, if the U.S. respects the law and fulfills its obligations, Iran will fully abide by its commitments, too. He said there's no point saying that Iran should return to the nuclear deal as the country never left it. Iran's president also said no provision of the accord will change and no new member will join it whatsoever. He said it's widely believed in the world that the Iran deal can be beneficial for international security, peace, and unity. In 2018, the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the accord and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Political commentator John White says the new U.S. administration has to return to the 2015 nuclear deal and compensate the Iranian nation for the harm it has caused.
I don't think they go far enough, actually. I think the Iranians are well within their rights to be demanding compensation from the Biden administration for the harm done to the Iranian economy as a result of the Trump administration's to pull out of the JCPOA, or the Iran deal, in 2018. I think Biden should approach the Iranians with a contrition and a spirit of humility on the understanding that Trump's decision to pull out unilaterally from this internationally agreed diplomatic deal negotiated with five different countries, a violation of international law and all norms of diplomacy. And I think the Biden administration has to come to the Iranian government with that in mind and offer some compensation, because the Iranian people have suffered enormously from these sanctions since Trump reimposed them and tightened them from 2018 onwards.
The International Court of Justice is set to rule on whether it can take on Iran's bid to overturn U.S. economic sanctions. The ruling is expected on Wednesday. Tehran filed its lawsuit in mid-2018 after the U.S. withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and reinstated sanctions. Tehran accused Washington of breaching a 1955 bilateral treaty and destroying millions of lives. The U.N.'s top court previously ruled that the U.S. should lift the sanctions. Washington, however, said the Hague-based court does not have jurisdiction over the case. Now, if the court decides to take on Iran's bid, a final ruling could be months or years away. The secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq is a prelude to its pullout from the entire region. Ali Shamkhani made the comment in a meeting with Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein in Tehran. Shamkhani said the presence of U.S. forces causes instability and crises in the region. He thanked Iraq for issuing arrest warrants for former U.S. President Donald Trump and his Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Tehran sees the two men as the main perpetrators of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq last year. At the meeting with Shamkhani, the Iraqi minister thanked Iran for its role in maintaining stability and security in the region. Two drones downed in 2 days, both belonging to Israel. One of them was brought down by Palestinian resistance forces in the Gaza Strip on Tuesday. Another was downed in Lebanon a day earlier. Resistance movement Hezbollah said it had shot down the drone after it violated Lebanese airspace.
Hezbollah said it shot down an Israeli drone near the border town of Blida. The downing of the drone
comes as the Israeli military has recently intensified its violations of the Lebanese airspace as part of what Hezbollah calls an ongoing spying operation against the resistance movement. Hezbollah fighters have so far downed several unmanned Israeli aircraft over the Lebanese territory. But Tel Aviv's frequently violating Lebanon's airspace is seen by many as a flagrant violation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701 and the country's sovereignty.
I think that Israel really is disregarding territorial sovereignty in general in Lebanon, in Gaza, and other places as well, Syria, Iraq. Israel has bombed militia in Iraq, and it's also involved. It's attacked forces in Libya as well. So I don't think that Israel really cares about honoring international protocols, international law. It just, at will violate any country's territory as long as it feels it's in its interest to do so. And I think it's been violating Lebanese territory for decades, really.
But such Israeli violations are not limited to Lebanon. On Tuesday, Palestinian resistance forces downed an Israeli drone in southern Gaza and took control of it. The Israeli military confirmed one of its drones crashed in Gaza, but claimed there was, quote, no danger of information leak. On Sunday, Palestinian fighters also shot down an Israeli quadcopter, which was conducting an espionage mission over Beit Hanun crossing in Gaza's northern border with the occupied territories. The Israeli military frequently uses drones over the Gaza Strip either to monitor and photograph Palestinian military units or bomb specified targets.
It uses drones regularly in Lebanon, I think, too, and in the Gaza Strip. It uses them for intelligence gathering. It's trying to watch what people do in those places. It's looking for militant activities that could be construed as, building missiles. It's looking for people that might be building tunnels under Gaza to defend Gaza in the next battle invasion from Israel. So these drones are an important intelligence tool for Israel. And drones are important intelligence tools for all the countries that make drones, the United States as well, and in countries where it's involved in the Middle East.
The downing of the Israeli drones in Palestinian and Lebanese territories brings this question. Is the Israeli regime ready to wage war? No, according to a top Israeli general. Back in 2018, this general said the Israeli military had invested most of its resources in the Air Force while neglecting the Land Corps. He said that had left Israel vulnerable to Hezbollah. Now, if the downing of the drone is anything to go by, then Israel has failed in its investment. That means no matter how much money goes into the Israeli military's air power, intelligence, and cyber warfare, it would be insufficient to protect the regime. And this statement comes from an Israeli general that the regime needs ground superiority to win any war.
Israel does not only use drones to sneak into the Lebanese airspace. Its U.S.-made F-35 stealth jets have also violated the country's airspace multiple times. In late January, Lebanese media said the Israeli regime used F-35 and F-15 warplanes to fly over the cities of Nabatiya, Eklima Tufa, and Tyre. They said it was the first time F-35 jets were used on such missions and that the flights were conducted at high altitude. Israeli aircraft has routinely breached the Lebanese airspace since 2000 when the regime was forced by Hezbollah to withdraw from Lebanon's south. The Lebanese government has filed hundreds of protest letters with the UN over airspace violations by Israel since the 2000 withdrawal. The letters have failed in ending Israel's almost daily breaching of Lebanon's sovereignty. Observers say Tel Aviv's overflights could be meant to send a message to Lebanon.
Well, I think that Israel views Hezbollah in Lebanon as a prime rival and a prime opponent. So Israel continuously sends its F-16s and F-35s over Lebanon. It also sends them up to attack Syria. So I think that I don't know that they're sending a message about the drones, but I think that they really want to track what Hezbollah is doing. They want to find out what plans it has. They want to track any missiles that may be coming through Syria into Lebanon so that they can keep track of that for the next time that there's a war, an invasion by Israel of Lebanon.
Israel has waged numerous wars against regional countries since it was installed in West Asia following World War II. The regime enjoys full support from its Western creators, most notably the U.S., Britain, and France. The U.S. alone has used its veto power at the U.N. Security Council many times to shield Tel Aviv from the full force of international law. This has further emboldened the regime to continue down the path it started in 1948.
Myanmar's police have filed charges against ousted de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi for illegally importing communications equipment. In a request to a court, police said they'd found walkie-talkie radios in a search of Suu Kyi's home in the capital. Police said she will remain in custody until mid-February for investigations. Earlier, Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy blasted the military for storming its offices in several regions. Suu Kyi and other NLD members were detained on Monday. As part of a military coup, the army claimed fraud in November's general election that Suu Kyi's party won by a landslide. Calls are now growing for civil disobedience, with medics already stopping work at dozens of hospitals across the country. World Health Organization experts investigating COVID-19 origins have visited a major virus research laboratory in the Chinese city of Wuhan. The lab has been at the center of conspiracy theories that spread over the origins of the pandemic. The theories claim that a laboratory leak caused the outbreak in Wuhan in December 2019. The Chinese city was the first place in the world to report COVID infections. Most scientists have rejected these theories. The WHO team began its probe in China last week. They've already visited key hospitals and a Wuhan seafood market. That's where the first cluster of COVID infections is believed to have originated. Stephen Rebay earlier joined us from Beijing. He gave us more details about the visit of the World Health Organization's team to the Wuhan virus lab.
The WHO team, after visiting the seafood market and the hospital where the disease was first identified, have actually visited the Wuhan Institute of Virology. It's swirling in conspiracy theories. Most scientists have actually rejected this, I think, because they know, you know, the process by which the horseshoe bat virus was tinkered with to enable it to infect human cells, and they can see that it's completely unrelated to the sequence of the genome which has been discovered now.
The United States has reported more than 100,000 COVID-19 deaths since the 1st of January 2021. According to Johns Hopkins University, the virus has claimed nearly 447,000 lives in the country since the first fatality was reported nearly a year ago. Confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus have also risen to over 26.4 million. Despite mass vaccination programs being underway in the virus-stricken U.S., the country remains the world's worst hit in terms of both infections and fatalities. Meanwhile, the overall global deaths from the virus have surpassed 2.2 million, and the total number of infected people is nearing 104 million. The issue of reopening schools during the pandemic in the U.S. has become intertwined with the increasing gap between the rich and poor. Schools in poor areas say they don't have the funding to reopen safely, but politicians and parents are pushing for a return to normality. Rami Mazzari has more from Chicago.
With a major teacher strike looming, Chicago has become the key battleground in the reopening of schools amid America's struggles handling the coronavirus. The root issue is not racial disparities or even health safety, but how the pandemic keeps worsening long-standing economic inequalities between the rich and poor classes. In the decentralized United States system, funding for schools comes mainly from local taxes. While schools in wealthy neighborhoods have plenty of resources for hand sanitizer and masks, schools in poor areas are being asked to cope with pandemic-related costs despite decades of non-investment.
Even if you open the schools, everyone still doesn't start from an equal place. You still have disparity. You still have lower quality of teachers. You still have outdated textbooks. You still have schools that don't have heat. You still have schools that may have lead in the water. very often those services are already lacking. So even to bring people back into the school system, you're still bringing them back into an unequal system.
This year, childcare costs have soared a back-breaking 60%. The U.S. has such a small social safety net that households with children usually require two working parents to survive economically, so reopening schools is a financial imperative for many. National health officials say schools should reopen and follow new health guidelines, but unions say a job walkout might be the only solution to show that poor areas don't have the resources to meet those guidelines.
I think that safety should be the first priority. And that, I think, would be difficult because we already have disparity in how different school systems are funded. We have disparity in what resources are in different schools. So this is a very difficult question and a very difficult problem for America to solve.
New U.S. President Joe Biden's push to reopen is the opposite of many Western nations who have reshuttered schools as a worrying coronavirus variant has emerged. Many have been surprised at the partial reopening now being politically ordered for many sectors of society, even though the daily nationwide death totals are still almost 60% more than the peak daily death totals last spring. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
The remains of the U.S. police officer who was killed last month during violent protests at Capitol Hill has been brought to the building for a ceremonial rest. President Joe Biden was present at the ceremony held on Tuesday night. Lawmakers will also pay their respect to Brian Sicknick during another ceremony on Wednesday. His remains will then be taken to Arlington National Cemetery for burial. Congress has said Sicknick would lie in honor. That's the term used for respecting the U.S.'s most eminent citizens. The 42-year-old officer succumbed to injuries he sustained after supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the Capitol building on January the 6th. Sicknick was one of the five victims of that incident. Elsewhere, the Italian president has tasked former European Central Bank chief Mario Draghi with forming a new government as the country struggles with multiple crises. Draghi has accepted the request of President Sergio Mattarella to try to form a new government. He will now hold consultations with different political parties in parliament and is expected to lead a government of national unity. Draghi's name emerged as a potential pick for premiership in recent weeks amid political turmoil in Italy combined with health and economic emergencies. The ruling coalition of former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte collapsed last month after his predecessor Matteo Renzi pulled out his Italia Viva party. They accused Conte of mishandling the health emergency and the subsequent economic crisis. Hundreds of people have fled to safety as a bushfire in Western Australia is burning out of control. The fire has already torn through large swaths of land, destroying at least 17 homes. It sparked on the outskirts of Perth on Monday and is the largest the city has seen in years. Firefighters have been battling the fire. At least six have received minor injuries. Australian authorities have warned that conditions might get worse due to strong winds fanning the flames. That comes as the city of Perth is in lockdown to contain its COVID outbreak, but officials have urged people to ignore the restrictions and to leave threatened areas. A SpaceX Starship prototype rocket has exploded as it tried to land upright after a test flight. The rocket was launched from a Texas launch site on Tuesday. It sent Silver Booster up to an altitude of more than 9 kilometers before landing with a deafening crash. It was the second such explosion after the last prototype of Starship met a similar fate in December. The rocket that blew up on Tuesday is known as Serial Number 9. It was a prototype for a super heavy lift rocket being developed for future missions to the moon and Mars. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration has said it will oversee an investigation into the incident. That's a wrap for now.
diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
European News Bulletin.
Hello, everyone, from the British capital, and we begin with our top story. Iran has called on the European Union to mediate a synchronized return of both Washington and Tehran to the 2015 nuclear deal. The latest call comes against the backdrop of crippling Trump-era sanctions against the Islamic Republic, the assassination of its top general, and continued American arms sales to Iran adversaries in the Persian Gulf. Saeed Poreza brings us up to speed.
It's been described as a Mexican standoff, with either side waiting for the other to blink first.
If Iran comes back into full compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA, the United States would do the same thing.
We acted in strict accordance with the nuclear agreement. Now the United States needs to come back into compliance, and Iran will be ready immediately.
But let's see who did what and when. Broadly, in May 2018, former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the nuclear deal and launched what came to be known as the Maximum Pressure Campaign on Iran. A year later, and in the absence of substantive action on the part of the European signatories to the agreement, Tehran started reducing its commitments to the accord. Given everything that happened between the two countries in 4 years of Trump, is the deal still worth the paper it's written on?
The fact of the matter is that that deal have not been honored, and if it continues not honoring the same deal, then really that deal is dead.
And Iran has offered a solution to the impasse. Get the Europeans involved. The man to get things running, EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell. But the Americans aren't only seeking Iran's return to full compliance. President Biden has spoken of follow-on negotiations, of a longer and stronger deal. Would Tehran take it?
Really, there is no goodwill between Iran and United States. So there is no way that you could actually extend your negotiation when you haven't honored what you have already agreed.
Iran's foreign minister has warned that the U.S. does not have unlimited time to return to the deal. And he is right. The Islamic Republic is holding presidential elections in June when power could change hands.
You know, it doesn't matter who is in power in Iran. Ordinary Iranians' experience of United States, be it at the time of Mossadegh or later on, and indeed Trumpism, has been very negative. They can't trust United States. And it is to this new administration to build that trust.
Not only that, Tehran is demanding the U.S. make up for its wrongdoings and to put an end to multi-billion dollar weapons sales to Persian Gulf dictatorships.
The path forward seems to be clear. The ball is in the court of the Biden administration to give diplomacy a second chance. And Europe can make sure diplomacy prevails. Saeed Pariza, London.
And Homer Lesgave joining us from Vienna. Homer, good to see you as always. Now, we heard there from the Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif hinting that perhaps the EU could play mediator here. What are your thoughts?
Yes, Amina, hello. Well, I'd just like to make it clear that the European Union has had a very central coordinating role since the JCPOA was actually signed and came into effect and implemented. It was envisaged as part of the text of the JCPOA that there would be joint commissions regularly being held, and most of the time they've been held here in Vienna, and that the EU will be part of that joint commission as coordinator, coordinating basically the Iranian side and the positions that are expressed by the Iranian side and the other parties to the deal, the United States when it was still part of the nuclear deal, and the three European signatories plus Russia and China. So that's the role that the EU has had in the joint commission sessions that we've been having here regularly. And now the fact that Foreign Minister Javad Zarif says that this is a time when the EU foreign policy chief, the lead EU coordinator, can act to basically help the two sides, as you call it, overcome this impasse. I think it is being seen as a step by Iran that shows that Iran does have the political will to get these issues resolved and to basically revive the JCPOA. Iran's UN ambassador, Majid Takht-Ravanchi, recently wrote in the New York Times in a piece, we know that Mr. Ravanchi was one of the main architects and negotiators of the deal. He said that basically, if the Biden administration does not lift the sanctions swiftly, then this will show the Iranians that there is no sincerity, and that the Iranian officials have said time and again that the window of opportunity is limited. We know that there is a deadline now that's been put forward by the parliament in Iran, the 21st of February. The mission now is what's going to happen from this stage up to that 21st of February date. Some analysts are suggesting that maybe the Biden administration, for instance, could use an executive order to revoke the withdrawal that President Trump signed, and then task the Treasury with reviewing the sanctions issue without, for instance, immediately lifting it. Now, this is just some scenario that's being viewed, and they see that they believe that, for instance, if the Biden administration takes this approach, maybe Iran would take a next confidence-building approach, and something could work out. But this does need coordination, something that Iran says the EU can do.
On a final note here, Homa, there is internal and external opposition to this deal going ahead. What basically could cause it to be diplomatically dead and buried, the point of no return?
Well, let's just look at the fact that the Biden administration has appointed as its Iran special envoy, Mr. Mali, who was one of the chief and lead negotiators in the deal. And this has been seen by analysts as a sign that the Biden administration does have basically the political will to keep this deal alive. A lot depends now on what the U.S. administration is going to do. Of course, Ms. Biden has said that he plans to come back into the deal, you know, and to lift the sanctions. But now it's the game, as some analysts are putting it, of the who goes first. The important thing is that the whole analysis that I've been reading about is that because the political will apparently is there, this is not an obstacle and it can be overcome. But there are, of course, as you said, opponents. There are people who were critical of the fact that Robert Malley was put in this position exactly because they do not want a deal at all. Not just a better deal, but no deal at all.
Indeed. And we'll continue to watch this space. Homer, thank you, as always. Now we move to some other news, because Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny was in court earlier on charges of violating his probation and charges that could have him sent back to prison for 3.5 years. The 44-year-old Kremlin critic was arrested on the 17th of January on arrival from Germany, where he'd spent 5 months recovering from an alleged nerve agent poisoning. Now, Navalny left hospital back in September but remained in Germany for 3 additional months and failed to check in with Russian authorities, thus violating his probation conditions. Those were set back in 2014 from a money laundering conviction. Navalny's detention has triggered protests across Russia over the past 2 weeks. And with me for further analysis here is the political commentator, Jyoti Bra. Jyoti, good to see you. Navalny, some would say, sees himself as something of a Russian revolutionary. His critics might disagree, perhaps seeing him closer to a Western-funded puppet encouraging social unrest. Where is the truth as far as you're concerned?
I mean, I think objectively the truth has to be, with the latter description, he's absolutely a pawn of the West. In the way that he's portrayed, the West distorts absolutely every aspect of Alexei Navalny. They distort his prominence. He's really a fringe figure in Russian politics. They distort the size of his following, which is actually very small. They distort his politics. They present him as a kind of a liberal hero, when the reality is he is bordering on fascistic nationalist white supremacist. And they distort the threat level that he poses to Vladimir Putin, which in reality is negligible, whereas the Financial Times today described him as Vladimir Putin's most prominent critic. Well, he might be prominent in Western newspapers, but in Russia, that's really not the case.
So what's next for him? Because, of course, we're carefully watching the case back in Moscow here. We saw today he gave a rather rambling speech to the judge. They've retired for the moment to consider what happens next. In your views, what's the next step for Mr. Navalny?
Well, I wouldn't like to second-guess the Russian justice system or the Russian political system. I think the political mood in Russia is not in favour of Mr. Navalny, but it's clear he has a huge amount of backing from the West, and that can't be ignored. We could very well be looking at a kind of rerun of the Venezuela situation, where Juan Guaido was plucked as the favourite of the imperialist world to try to use as a figurehead and a spearhead to create a movement behind him to disrupt a state that was being run by people who they feel are hostile to their interests. So it's clear that's how they want to use Mr. Navalny. If they're successful in that, I'm not convinced they will be, but certainly we haven't seen the end of them manoeuvring and trying to create at least the appearance of some kind of a movement to justify further aggressive moves on their part.
On a final note here, Russia has made its concerns clear about perhaps the role of some social media apps in helping to fuel some of these pro-Navalny protests. Very briefly, your thoughts on how they seem to stir the pot, yet still be financial situations that are not supposed to be political?
Well, we've seen time and again in recent years, haven't we, the fact that the social media platforms are big monopoly corporations, very much invested in the US imperialist project. And again, we see manipulations as well as outright censorship to make sure that the messages that US imperialism wants to be promoted get promoted, and messages that are counter to their agenda are crushed. So it's par for the course, I'm afraid.
All right, par for the course indeed. Jyoti Bra, thank you. Now we move across to Russia, because the country's foreign minister has denounced the military coup taking place in Myanmar, urging the military to return to democratic norms and release political prisoners. The coup has led to the arrest of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi, President Win Myint, and other senior figures from the governing party. The military takeover began in the early hours of Monday, on the day that parliament was set to swear in new members. This after the military accused Ms. Suu Kyi's party of electoral fraud. The UK, the USA, and the European Union have all condemned the detention of Myanmar prisoners and echoed the growing international calls for return to the democratic process.
This is European News Bulletin, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Well, we cross, unfortunately, Richard Sedan, back to the United States here, where there's been some sobering news And I think you don't have to be political here. You might have to be a parent, a sister, a brother, to really take some discomfort and some heart in what you're about to share with us.
Exactly, just some basic human empathy, really. A video has gone viral of a 9-year-old black child, a girl, being assaulted by police in the US in Rochester.
I counted at least 5 police officers there, Richard.
Precisely, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, Amina. Let's just call it what it looks like. This was the assault by a group of white men on a black child. And, you know, I think the reality is we all know that if we were talking about a 9-year-old white child from, say, Beverly Hills, you and I, Amina, would simply not be having this conversation. But the reality is the US police are completely corrupted by white supremacists. You cannot appeal to any sense of morality with these people because they have no sense of morality. They need to be incentivized to stop what they're doing, but there is no incentive because the police operate within a bubble of impunity. They are barely punished. Would anyone be talking about the police even taking action, Amina, were it not for this video? You know, many people really believe the police are simply not fit for purpose in the United States. And this is yet another stark reminder that we're not just talking about black adults here. We're talking about a black child. For many, being black in America is a crime in itself. And of course, we learn that from the horrendous murder of Trayvon Martin by a white supremacist a few years ago. Trayvon Martin was 17 years old. He was also a black child. And I'm afraid, you know, we simply see more and more of these incidents, and nothing but serious action is really going to stop these incidents from occurring, and certainly not the rhetoric from President Biden, who many would argue has made a career of pushing through anti-black policies in the US.
And of course, before I let you get into the brief social media outpouring here, the police chief of the union in Rochester has come out to defend his officers, saying they acted within the bounds of the law. I can't see how that you could have looked at that objectively and come to that conclusion. Perhaps social media disagrees with his analysis, Richard.
They certainly do. So Derek Bird says, it doesn't matter how police bootlickers try to explain this. Pepper spraying a handcuffed 9-year-old girl is torture. And Justice Wisdom for Peace says, what is wrong with American cops? Pepper spray a 9-year-old black girl in handcuffs, but join and take selfies with white supremacists who storm the Capitol to take over. So many people are going to be keeping an eye on this issue here, Amina, but unfortunately we are seeing more and more of these incidents occur, and I think they're possibly going to get ramped up if no action is taken.
All right, Richard, obviously a young woman forever traumatized. All right, we go back to the UK now because the country's health secretary, Matt Hancock, well, he's announced 105 cases of the new variant of coronavirus first identified in South Africa. He's saying they've been discovered in the UK, with 11 of those cases having no links to international travel. Speaking at a Downing Street news conference, the health secretary said the government plans on conducting 80,000 tests in a handful of high-risk areas in an attempt to stop the spread of this new mutation. The UK currently has the 5th highest number of COVID cases, with over 3.84 million confirmed cases and over 107,000 deaths. French lawmakers have begun to tackle a new bill which they say will target their so-called definition of radical Islam. The controversial Macron-backed bill proposes over 1,700 amendments, including the close monitoring of mosques and the creation of an imam charter. This sets out a list of republican values Muslim leaders must adhere to. The news comes weeks after 36 NGOs from 13 different countries submitted a formal letter of complaint to the UN demanding immediate legal action against France over its violation and treatment of Muslim citizens' rights. Robert Inlakesh, could it be that the world is taking a new humanitarian approach to the situation in Yemen?
Well, it seems that it is being portrayed that way. We pulled up a headline here which reads, Saudi human rights under new spotlight in Biden era. And this seems to be what is being presented throughout the press, that Biden's administration is one that is going to take a stance against human rights violations by Saudi, but that doesn't exactly seem to be what he's doing. He has frozen weapons sales to Saudi Arabia and also the United Arab Emirates, but many are saying this is just the normal process, and Joe Biden can essentially leverage what he would like to get out of Saudi Arabia during this time which the contracts are froze. And so when we're looking at this issue, it might not be that Joe Biden is particularly concerned with Yemen. He hasn't yet reversed the designation of Ansar Allah or the Houthis as a terrorist organization, which is essentially blocking aid from going inside of Yemen, the number one humanitarian catastrophe on the planet at this moment, as per the United Nations. They're the ones that declared it as such. But what we're seeing is instead is that there's this pressuring of Saudi Arabia perhaps to normalize ties with Israel, and that's why we're seeing such a spotlight being shined on the Saudis now. I would argue it's nothing to do with their human rights violations. There's been very little talk of the human rights violations, but a lot of pressure seems to be applied on them. So it's a bit of a leap of the imagination to believe that suddenly they care about human rights when under the Obama administration, where Joe Biden was vice president, they're the ones that essentially started and backed this war.
Indeed. The social media reaction with the backdrop here that perhaps Biden's just a smoother operator trying to negotiate a little bit more out of the deal. What's social media saying?
First comment we've got here reads, after 100,000 deaths in the war in Yemen, Italy finally stops the sale of 12,700 bombs to Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, just like Biden's move too late. And we've got, and then they say at the end there, but at least Italy will actually go ahead with it. And then we've got another one here by a user called Mason who says, it's all a lie about the arms freeze. It's just procedural. The media are making too much out of this.
Well, we're at least casting a critical gaze there, Robert. The next story, this is an interesting one. Perhaps for a country with such a large percentage of Muslim population, perhaps Kosovo normalizing ties with the occupation force in Tel Aviv was not something we thought we'd be seeing so swiftly here.
Yes, it's something that's came a little bit out of the blue, but it indicates many different things here. We do know that Kosovo has had these connections with Israel for some years, like the United Arab Emirates did, but it's a smaller player on the grand scheme of things here. But of course, this is being seen as an insult to many Muslims around the world, the fact that yet again another country with many Muslims in who reside inside of it are normalizing ties with Israel. There were those connections made as well last year as well, so this is not completely without precedent here. However, what this does indicate, and I think this is the context, the wider context in which it should be viewed as, is that the Biden administration has paved the way for more of this to happen, and he's vowed, and so has Antony Blinken as Secretary of State, that they are going to go ahead and try and get more countries to normalize ties with Israel. But there has been some pushback. Reportedly, the EU today has threatened Kosovo if it wants to move its embassy to Jerusalem instead of Tel Aviv. So Jerusalem al-Quds, if it's moved there, there may be some backlash.
But what's in this for Kosovo? Praise from the Americans? Because this was a deal brokered by President Trump.
Yes, exactly. And so when we're looking at this here, and again, this is something that's been carried on through the Biden administration here, it does look like Kosovo, like others, will probably have some small minor gains here, but a lot of bullying goes on. So for instance, the United States can use its leverage in order to get small countries to normalized ties with Israel, and countries which are not so much economically dependent, like we've seen in the case of Sudan as well. That's the way they sort of blackmailed them there. And so United States pressure wins out at the end of the day.
Unfortunately. And what are some of the viewers saying online?
The first comment we've got here reads, normalization with the Israeli apartheid regime has only one explanation, which is theft of more and more Palestinian lands. Kosovo wants to prove its existence through an apartheid regime, that's Israel. And then the next one here we've got says, well, isn't it great to see Biden doing exactly the same as what Trump did? Proves that the U.S. doesn't change through elections.
Wise words, softly spoken. Thank you, Robert Inlakesh. And that's where we leave you. Until next time.
In the limelight.
Irrespective of whether or not they keep the word, the UN and the West, if they are really sincere in their lip service for the world's most persecuted people, should seriously engage the military rulers to redress the plight of the Rohingya, instead of shedding tears for Aung San Suu Kyi and her so-called civilian colleagues, who had rigged the recent elections to secure 322 seats required to form the government. Dear listeners, these words were part of an article written by the staff of Kahan International. This article is published under the heading, "Would the cruel woman's ouster end cruelties for Rohingya Muslims?" Please stay tuned for the details of this article. Monday, February 1st, military coup in Myanmar, following widespread reports of fraud in the recently held parliamentary elections, has effectively ended the dubious power of the so-called democratic regime, which was anything but the people's true representative. Senior General Min Aung Hlaing, who seized power after a series of warnings by the military to the supposedly elected cabinet, has thrown into prison President Yu Win Myint and State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi, the woman who exercised the real power, including the intensification of the genocide of the Rohingya Muslims. The question that arises is, does the ouster of that cruel woman, to quote the apt description of Aung, ends the cruelties for the Rohingya Muslims? The answer seems in the negative. Given the cruel nature of General Min, who has overseen campaigns against several of the country's ethnic minority groups, including the Rohingya, the Shan, and the Kogong. In other words, the coup is not expected to improve the situation of the world's most persecuted people, as the UN has described the Rohingya Muslims. Presently, 1,300,000 Rohingya refugees live in squalid camps in Bangladesh, mostly in the Cox's Bazar area. Following the mass exodus of the years 2017 to 2018, when Aung San Suu Kyi intensified the genocide in Rakhine State a year after her coming to power as an elected civilian ruler. A woman with a tarnished reputation because of her cooperation with the military and her vociferous defense of the deadly campaign against the Rohingya, during her trial in 2019 in the International Court of Justice, she tried to justify the ethnic cleansing of Muslims. It should be noted that UN officials and Human Rights Watch have described Myanmar's persecution of Rohingya Muslims as ethnic cleansing. The UN Human Rights Envoy to Myanmar has reported the long history of discrimination and persecution against the Rohingya community could amount to crimes against humanity. Probes by the UN have found evidence of increasing incitement of hatred and religious intolerance by ultra-nationalist Buddhists against Rohingya Muslims, while the Myanmar security forces have been conducting summary executions, enforced disappearances, arbitrary arrests and detentions, torture and ill-treatment, and forced labor against the community. This means the coup that was announced on a military-owned Midawari TV would not bring any relief to the Rohingyas, unless the UN steps up efforts and pressures the new rulers to take back the refugees. The military rulers, who cited the 2008 Constitution, which allows the military to declare a national emergency, have declared a state of emergency and said they will remain in power for a year. Irrespective of whether or not they keep their word, the UN and the West, if they are really sincere in their lip service for the world's most persecuted people, should seriously engage the military rulers to redress the plight of the Rohingya, instead of shedding tears for Aung San Suu Kyi and her so-called civilian colleagues, who had rigged the recent elections to secure 322 seats required to form the government.
Epic. Epic. Glory. Honor. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.